Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy. Hybrid Jazz is a vision of all that is jazz, both traditional and contemporary, domestic and global. Here's your host, Trish Hennessy.
Thank you very much, Dave Solomon. And here we are, recording live on what? December 13th. Look, do I have to tell you that we've got 12 days to go? Yeah. Sad, isn't it? It's not. It's just that it goes by so quickly after Thanksgiving. Zip, zip, zip. What is the deal with that? So glad you could join me today. I'm Trish Hennessy. This is Hybrid Jazz from moi. As if to distinguish anybody else who wants to pick up the hybrid thing, so you'll know that you heard the music on this show and not anybody else's show. That's all. And I imagine there's going to be more of that because it seems to be a trend for folks to be more exploratory, as it will, in regards to jazz, and a lot more acceptance now of what can be described as jazz, or so I think. Not that there's anything wrong with somebody going into a purely straight-ahead vein or a purely contemporary vein, but all of that wonderful stuff that falls in between those cracks, bring it on! I'm not sure what this particular song is going to fall into, what kind of category that we're going to play first, but I think that you'll judge that it belongs on the show. One of the coolest songs in the world, a holiday treat for you. And don't forget, one of the most special guests I can think of coming up next hour that's inside, also known as Norman Woods. It's going to be a really cool show. Without further ado, whack-a-doo, let us celebrate, shall we, with a 5-pound box of money from Pearl Bailey.
Hey, Santa Claus, you want to make me happy this year? Listen to me, honey. Give Pearl something that'll be of some use to me, like a 5-pound box of money. Now, that vast little gift is loaded with lots of sentiment. See, whenever I get blue, Santa, I'm going to think of you. But at the same time, I will change to pay my rent, you see? Now, money isn't everything. There's no two ways about it. But while we're here, Santa dear, it's much better with than without it. So, really, I could be real good and not do nothing funny. If you do like I ask you, start me right on Christmas night. Try me, try me. Try me on that money. Just try me, honey. Santa, can you hear me? You listen to everything I'm asking about? But listen, honey, Santa dear, the new year, oh, it would be so bright and sunny. Just bring me that little simple thing I've been speaking to you about. Like that, maybe a 5-pound box of money. That's all, that's all. It would be so heavenly and help me meet both ends. Yes, indeed. What old Pearl really needs is that 5-pound box of tin. How much can it weigh? I ask you, how much? I don't want the whole money tree. What good is that big thing to me? You keep the branches. You can keep the trunk and the root. Because all that I want is just a little bit of the fruit. So if you want to be sure, I'll be your little old honey, honey bunny. You try me. Start me off on Christmas night with a 5-pound. No, I better increase that. Make it 10 pounds. No, I better put in a good bag while I'm begging, because, I mean, I'll catch you next year. You know, people go out. Sometimes you don't see them no more, so bring the money. Santa, can you hear me? Santa, bring me some money. Oh, Santa. Now, what I want with this diamond? Are you kidding? Thank you.
seemed like such an appropriate song to play on a gorgeous day like today. Oh, my goodness. The sun is out in Baltimore. It is a pretty world. Brazil, 66 right there. I'm just thinking that usually when I play the first three songs, this is the longest spiel that I have. And honestly, if I was to tell you the history of each of the acts that you've just heard, we'd be here from now until next Tuesday, okay? You'd be wrapping presents and making cookies like Suzanne here in the chat room, still going, when is she going to shut up? But honestly, Sergio Mendes and Brazil 66, we used to hear them back in the day all the time on WIP. Great little AM station back then in Philly, still is, but now it's a sports radio station, not the same. They were playing adult, middle of the road, and jazz back then, and man, I heard this sound, and it was so awesome. Of course, everybody was getting excited because of the bossa nova back then. Here's just a little background. Sergio Mendes was born in Brazil, and he studied classical piano there, but his real interest was in jazz. So it got to the point where he started to play the clubs in the late 50s, just about the time that samba took on this new flavor, the infusion of jazz into it, which meant bossa nova. He was playing with his mentor, the great Antonio Carlos Jobim, so this was becoming very organic, the experience to get involved in music. And Sergio met Herb Alpert and Jerry Moss at A&M Records. They took an interest in what Sergio had in mind for a group, with two gals in the front to make it seem kind of attractive, appealing with all these musicians. Well, they really got it going when one of the gals was replaced with Lonnie Hall from Chicago, who did not know Portuguese, but she learned it phonetically and quickly. And then the story I love is that Sergio got really mad at Herb Alpert because Herb and Lonnie fell in love, and Herb took Lonnie away from Brazil 66. That's a whole other story and possibly a Lifetime movie someday, but I'm sure they're going to be considering that down the road. That was Pretty World from the best of. Oh, go get yourself some feel-good, gently vibrating, always melodic Sergio Mendes and Brazil 66 music. It's just great. McCoy Tyner, who just had a birthday the other day, we heard from Infinity from 1995. And just a little blurb about McCoy. Of course, on that trio album, which some consider some of the finest music in jazz, period, the late, great Michael Brecker on sax, Avery Sharp on bass, Aaron Scott on drums, and Valentino Anastasio on percussion. You heard Flying High, 10 minutes and 16 seconds. I love that track because 10-16 is my birthday. Anyway, Philly-born, 1938, McCoy's mom was a beautician who played a little piano in her spare time, and she said one day when he was young, McCoy, you have a choice. Either you're going to take singing lessons or you're going to study piano. So he has on his website, McCoyTyner.com, I'm so glad I chose piano. We are too. God bless him. Woo! What is he, 73 the other day? 73, going strong too, playing Atlanta in early 2012 for our Atlanta folks. Pearl Bailey started the hour, Lord have mercy, 5-pound box of money. You can find that in a couple of different places. Doo-Wop Christmas, which features the moon glows and the Cadillacs and the Orioles. Really a great compilation. You can find that on Amazon. And you can also find on Amazon Hipsters Holiday, featuring jazz and R&B, Mabel Scott, Miles Davis, Lionel Hampton. This story about Pearl, who many of us know who are of a certain age because we remember her TV show, we remember her in Hello, Dolly, which just garnered so many accolades. She was a singer, a dancer, award-winning, too. Her brother, Bill, was a tap dancer. You might know that name, Bill Bailey. He suggested at the age of 15 that she enter a singing contest in Philadelphia. She did, and she won, and the same thing happened at the Apollo. And from there, holy cow, she was in Carmen Jones, she was in Porgy and Bess, she was in St. Louis Blues, married and a great marriage to Louis Belson, the great drummer, and two adopted kids. One of the cool things that you might not know about Pearl Bailey is that she got her BA later in life in theology at Georgetown University. She was just full of life till the end. And I just found out today that she is buried in Westchester, which is just up the street from Philly. So next time around, I'll have to go pay a visit to Pearlie and see what's happening with her. God love her. We really miss her so much. And another thing, too, in 1941, she was playing the Philly nightclubs, but she was touring with the USO. And I can't stress that enough. She really made it a point to get involved. She was an ambassador. Gerald Ford, as a matter of fact, recognized her as such, and she got an honor from Ronald Reagan. Just a great human being all the way around. And we love to play those folks like Norman Woods that you'll hear next hour who like to give back, not like have to give back because of what they have experienced in their lifetime, whether that experience has been good or bad. David Sanborn, he has a Horace Silver song. I just love the CD Closer, and I like this song so much. David Sanborn, what can you say? He's another guy, had polio when he was little, and made it a point to be a mentor to so many people. Just a great guy all the way around. And sometimes, most of the time, I venture to say, that when people are good inside with good intent, their music becomes that much more appealing. Like you can't live without their music because it's so healing. Like this, Enchantment from Closer on Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy. Yes.
Thank you.
That is some kind of song. You can put Michael McDonald in front of me anytime. And within a couple of seconds, I'll be all weepy. He just does that. Oh, my. Especially when he is surrounded by people who get him, Not that it's going to take anybody with rocket science necessarily to get him. He just has a particular way of being soulful. Matter of fact, Brian Culberson, A Soulful Christmas, is where you can find that tune all through this Christmas night. So you got Brian Culberson on keyboard, you got Michael McDonald singing, and Eric Marienthal on saxophone. Those are three pretty soulful white boys. Let me tell you something. Man, I don't know what is going on, but this CD, if you probably know about Brian's CD, is just full of fun and also spiritually laden songs. And I just want to tell you some more of the personnel on that particular track. Wayne Bergeron on trumpet, Paul Jackson Jr. on guitar, Ricky Peterson on the Hammond, Maurice Fitzgerald on bass, Oscar Seton Jr. on drums, God bless Lenny Castro on percussion, and the Jason White Ensemble doing their thing in the background, sounding beautiful. Brian Culberson is going to be part of that huge jazz cruise happening in January. David Sanborn's going to be on the same cruise. It is sold out. Sanborn's one of the co-hosts along with Marcus Miller. All right, it's called the Smooth Jazz Cruise. I don't want to say the S word, but all right. Brian just got signed to the Berks Jazz Festival, so he'll be there on April the 1st, I believe he said. Go to brianculbertson.com and learn more. Michael McDonald just got wrapping up some dates in Florida, and I think he's going to be holding on to Amy Holland, his wife, real tight this Christmas, along with Dylan, who's, what, 25 now? I can't believe it. I remember when Dylan was born, and Scarlett, his daughter, who's a year older than my son. She is 20. That is just so hard to believe. Ahmad Jamal, hey, what other radio show do you know that plays Michael McDonald and Ahmad Jamal back-to-back? Okay. All right, enough said. Snowbound, the name of the song. I know I've played that before, but it's Ahmad Jamal, okay? And it's from Live at the Alhambra. It's also on Cross Country Tour, 1958 to 1961. The trio consists of course, Ahmad on keyboard, just as much for what he plays as what he does not play. You know, or maybe you don't, but Miles Davis was just so inspired by what Ahmad Jamal did on that keyboard, the nuance that he had, the clean, minimalist approach, because he knew that people to their ear wanted to hear something that wasn't busy. They wanted to hear the essence of the tune. He just got that so much. Vernell Fournier from New Orleans on the drums, bassist Israel Crosby. And, man, I just found out that you can get a 9-CD box set from mosaicrecords.com. What a Christmas present that would be, $149 for that Ahmad Jamal set. And he's one of these guys like McCoy Tyner guys, one of these legends that you just want to hold on to and embrace for all that you're worth. Ahmad is 81 years old, and I am going to tell you straight that it's my mission to try to get him on this show, Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy, in 2012. Anything to get the legends to talk about what their experience has been, because these cats lived through some times that most of us screaming weenies would not be able to stomach. You know what I'm saying? We're all so spoiled, especially in the States. These men grew up, grew out, got over it, and lived to tell the tale. Just great men. David Sanborn, Enchantment from Closer. 24 albums, 6 Grammy Awards, 8 Stone Cold CDs, 1 platinum. You know the story of Sanborn. Butterfield Blues Band at Woodstock, Talking Book with Stevie Wonder, Young Americans via David Bowie. Man, has he had some kind of history. You go to his website, find out what he's doing. He's going to take a rest because he was real busy in this year as far as touring is concerned. And I'm just chomping at the bit because this cruise happening in January is going to feature a couple of favorites, Candy Dulfer, Kirk Whalum, and Joe Sample. Imagine them with David Sanborn, Marcus Miller. There's a lot of other folks involved, but those are the ones that just went meep, meep, meep when they stood out on the page when you were reading the lineup of the talent. Do not forget, Inside, also known as Norman Woods, joins us in less than 25 minutes or so. Looking forward to this. You talk about a man who has paid some dues. I just cannot say enough about what you are going to hear, and he will just go. Norman will just go for days telling you about his story because he's just so high now on the possibility of saving people who do not want to save themselves. And that speaks volumes about the kind of individual we have coming up very soon. Let's get more into the holiday spirit, shall we? This is an interesting guy, Kurt Bester, his version of Carol of the Bells on Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy. Listen in. Thank you. Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy.
I want to share something with you. Sometimes I'm not sure what, but I feel it coming. But for now, the most important thing I want you to know is that you are not alone. My pulse amplified, reverberating life beats, unsure if it's nervous fear or growing anticipation of what comes next. And only by sharing this from my heart will I be allowed to come into yours. Instead of being trapped within painful, misdirected methods of sublimation, I will recover and create waves of encouragement to overpower this medicated adolescence which stifles my maturity. I will make it possible to unify scattered messages of how to complete a thought so that you can learn to trust me while I search for the verse. Let the journey begin. I've had joyful days, haven't you? And I've had painful ones, haven't you? And who can really say they're qualified to assess what's relevant but those from the experience itself? Now, this is not to tell you what you should think, nor aggravate or agitate, because life has a way of doing that for all of us. You and I begin to count down, heading toward the next challenge, the next rise, the next fall, and we have the desire to speak of it. I pay close attention, knowing that teachers are born through dialogue. But me, I start with the verse. I want this verse to ask things like, can I share my strength with you? If I grow weak and afraid, will you wait for me to find courage? Will you wait for me to write my next poem? My heartstring pulls on unconscious suppression, where great thoughts hide after being bludgeoned with an illegal competence. I listen but don't speak for reasons unknown, but I am not paranoid. Silently, I wait for godly inspiration to write. Critical discourse does not lead to chemically induced revelations. You know, you understand, and soon enough, with patience, you perceive. So what I want you to do is hold on, wait, without despair. Knowing someone is calling you through verse, understanding your next doubt, your next blessing. Break the matrix of structure, not become fixtures that prohibit love communities. Just might be your next lesson. Because discovery of the verse will introduce you to where real passion begins. I write it for you to hear. Will you trust and let it in? Let it take you to your next smile, or help your soul be filled with light. Because discovery is the journey, and your heart will say, it feels right.
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed. Inside, also known as, or on Norman Woods, and he'll be with us momentarily. That one is the first one I wanted to play for you this afternoon, Discovery, a Gift Within a Verse, from Still Loving the Art of It. And let me tell you something. I received so many CDs and some film this past week or so. My head is ready to explode, and all of it is good. The reason why it's going to explode is so good. I so believe in this man and what he has tried to accomplish, what he has endured in this journey, and you'll hear about it coming up in the next couple of minutes, is just something that needs to be talked about, especially during this holiday season, again and again, because people feel adrift as much as people want to feel happiness, and this is a season for happiness, there are those that cannot even speak about their pain. So that was a reason why Norman was so important to have on the show today. Norman Woods, Inside. Yes. And we heard Take Six. All you need to know about Take Six, and their website is just delicious, is on takesix.com. From the 1991, He Is Christmas, God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen with the Yellow Jackets. Now, I know that the group has had a more recent CD, but I just wanted to play that song. That's when Dr. Cedric Dent was still with the group. Just so you know, on the 16th, they are going to be at the Mahalia Jackson Theater for the Performing Arts. On the 18th, Take Six will be in Miami. And I'm going to put a bookmark in a thought because I saw something from Claude McKnight's page on Facebook today that made me stop in my tracks. Because my son and I were just talking about reading material, especially for the holidays, and I came across C.S. Lewis in Mere Christianity. And I thought, okay, this is getting into the year where I'm going to get immersed in C.S. Lewis because he had such a powerful message, having been godless, in a sense, for such a while. So I'm going to tell you what Claude put on his wall today. But first, let me tell you that you did hear Kurt Bester, Carol of the Bells, and he is so amazing. You'll find that on a couple of different compilations. But what's so fascinating about Kurt is, among other things, he's one of those undiscovered secrets. He's a multi-instrumentalist, a composer, an Emmy Award winner, a talk show host. Life is good in Utah, where he is. He has been doing for 24 years a tour that is usually sold out all over the western part of the U.S. He doesn't get to the East Coast too much, but he has done an abundance of TV shows and films and done his thing with orchestras, Untold, and speaks Serbo-Croatian, German, and Swahili because his wife used to work in Africa. He's just really something else, and I love that version of Carol of the Bells, and where I found it is on one of those wonderful little CDs. It's called Smooth Yule from the mid-90s. Just an amazing array of talent on there and songs. Jesu and also, gosh, I'm losing my train of thought just because I'm excited that Inside is coming up. But let me find the CD so I can give you a little taste of what's on there. Kitaro's on there, Lo, How a Rose, Air Blooming, Dave Grusin, John Tesh is on here. Also, Otmar Liebert, and Dave Koz, Tom Scott, Kevin Eubanks, really choice stuff. Now, I see that Norman's on the line, and that's great. But I just wanted to tell you something that Claude McKnight wrote on his wall today, and it really bears a message for the holiday season. This is from C.S. Lewis, Mere Christianity. One of the dangers of having a lot of money is that it may be quite satisfied that you might be quite satisfied with the kinds of happiness money can give, and so fail to realize your need for God. If everything seems to come simply by signing checks, you may forget that you are at every moment totally dependent on God. Now, quite plainly, natural gifts carry with them a similar danger. If you have sound nerves and intelligence and health and popularity and a good upbringing, you are likely to be quite satisfied with your character as it is. Why drag God into it? You may ask a certain level of good conduct comes fairly easily to you. You are not one of those who are wretched creatures who are always being tripped up by sex or dipsomania or nervousness or bad temper. Everyone says you are a nice chap, and between ourselves, you agree with them. You are quite likely to believe that all this niceness is your own doing, and you may easily not feel the need for any better kind of goodness. Often people who have all these natural kinds of goodness cannot be brought to recognize Christ at all until one day the natural goodness lets them down and their self-satisfaction is shattered. In other words, it is hard for those who are rich in this sense to enter the kingdom. Just thought that was very thoughtful from Claude McKnight, who has gone through some challenges, capital C, himself in his life. And we can't talk about them, but we will talk about insights, challenges, revelations, all of those, and many more. He is somebody I've looked forward to speaking with on this show. And honestly, I just got to know who he was a few months ago, but things progressed rather quickly. Didn't they, Norman? Are you there, sir?
Hello?
Hello, I'm here. Are you?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Of course I can. I'm just teasing you a little bit, as I am prone to do, as I will do during the hour or whenever this takes us. Lord knows you've been getting the big build-up, Norman Woods, a.k.a. Inside. How are you? And I'm just thrilled to have you here.
I am doing quite well, considering circumstances and challenges. I'm pretty optimistic. I'm kind of a little nervous because, with this build-up you gave me, I'm like going, I hope I can feel the bill.
Oh, no. Listen, your life is the bill. You don't have to embellish. Your life says who you are and what you did with it. So no need to be nervous. It's just me.
And your listeners. No, I'll be fine. After a couple of sentences, I'll be right. I'll be all right.
Oh, listen, if it's anything like yesterday where I had to say, okay, Norman, I'm going to get off the phone now, and three, I'm going to get off the phone now, as I did.
I am trying to behave. I am really, really trying to make sure I behave. I was just so touched by the nature of what we were talking about. It was just, you know, pure blessing and pure grace, and I just wanted to embrace all of it that I was allowed to, you know, because that's how I live my life. You know, I celebrate everything that comes to me through grace. And I try to pass it to the next person immediately while it's fresh, vibrant, and hot and, you know, encouraging.
I know you do. And you said a couple of things yesterday on the phone that just, wow, were revelatory. And I have to share them with the audience and the very active chat room. My, we're busy in the chat room. You said something along the lines of what people do. You had a certain expression. What people do to you to make you feel badly or question yourself because you're not giving them stuff for free, advice for free, when you know that you are worth getting paid to do those things.
Guilt hustling. I called it guilt hustling.
Guilt hustling.
Guilt hustling.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
When someone's trying, when you're trying to show somebody that your moral compass is intact and your ethics are, you know, solid and that they can trust the exchange of the relationship and they let you keep doing that and they let you keep doing that while they're sitting there being silent, contemplating the advantages that they might be able to take of your effort to let them know that you're an honest person, that you're straight up. And I say that only leaning when it leans toward a negative result, which my case was. A lot of money, lost a lot of money, heartbreaks, you know, but I am not discouraged.
Oh, no, because, you know, there was a conversation yesterday. Yesterday was one of those days I told you I was talking to another gentleman who I absolutely love, who is going through his own metamorphosis. And, you know, we talked about the things that trip you up in life. And he cautioned me about having my particular kind of faith as I move on. And I told you, Norman, that I told him, what can you do but go forward? You even talked about what your dad said to you about falling forward.
That's right. He said, fall forward. He said, fall forward. And he said, and I didn't know why he said forward, because I was thinking in the terms of vanity, I'm going to fall on my face. But he said, no, Norman. He said, fall forward. because when you get up, you'll be a couple of inches down the road, a little farther toward where you're trying to get to. And
I
try to remember that. I try to remember that.
I mean, what else can you do? You have had some challenges today or in the past 24 hours since I've talked to you, but what can you do? All you can do, because you're built this way now. It's not that you were always this way, but you're a fresh person today. You're different than you were 10 minutes ago. So all you need to know to do is to keep moving forward, because your mission is to empower other people. The world would be lost without you doing that, honestly.
And, you know, one of the things I try to remember and I try to practice is that when I feel overwhelmed or ineffective in my efforts to reach people or touch people's hearts, I lower the bar. Because if you lower the bar of the expectations, I guarantee you'll find some asset or some attribute that you have shared. It can come in the form of a smile, a thank you. Sometimes we get so preoccupied with our objectives that we pass by the thing that really reinforces that state of being, what we're trying to maintain, which is to do well and not sit with your hand out, not waiting for a particular type of payoff, but just the gift of participation. So I always say, you know, regardless of who gets me or who I affect, if what I did came from my heart, I lower the bar and say, thank God you're able to express things from your heart. You know, so you can always find something to feel grateful for and appreciate. If you, I have this analogy that I use. I go, stop the presses. Kill the story, because if the story is taking you to a less than satisfying place, then you need to stop. And you need to just stop that story, and you need to go, wait a minute, let me go back to that story that brought that smile to my face. Let me go back to that thank you and that God bless you that someone gave you, or that favor that someone out of the blue called you and said thank you for. There are things to appreciate if you stop that wheel and get off of that self-destructive guinea pig wheel that says not enough, can't do, why is this happening, and so forth.
Yeah, well, you just said a whole mouthful, that's for sure, because there's what you're basically saying is, and we see it all the time on Facebook, that's for sure, there are people who believe that life is half empty all the time, as opposed to even half full some of the time. It's all that you and I can do. I know that you try, I do too, to pull people back and say, come on now, you know what? You are not the only person in the world who is victimized. You are not the only person in the world suffering. If you realize the kind of real suffering that other people were going through, not to diminish, you know, people's feeling pain, even physical pain for suffering, but my God, we have allowed ourselves to become narcissists, especially in the United States of America, where things are readily given to us, and we don't even say thank you for them anymore. We just take them and run.
That's right. And, you know, we get stuck on that perpetual story, that one that we've invested so many layers in, and you just get stuck on that story, and somebody tries to tap you on your shoulder and say, you don't have to be a character in that story anymore. But until somebody comes along and tells you that, you know, it's kind of hard when we're so preoccupied with reading and writing our own stories. We just read the same story over and over based on expectations that may not consider the world around us and where we fit and how we adjust. I mean, when you talk about the where we live here in the United States and what we perceive, I remember, as you know, and I don't mind saying this for reference only, when I was homeless in Seattle, Washington, and I would eat food off of people's plates in the pizza parlor, and I just would see how much food people wasted. And I'm not trying to do this melancholy, sad thing. I'm just saying that's the fact of the matter. I've seen what it feels like to be next to nothing and not have very many options of what one can appreciate. So when you have that kind of experience, your whole life changes. Your whole life changes, you know. And I've seen many things of waste. And like you said, we're not pointing fingers and stuff, but I'm telling you adamantly, wholeheartedly, that there are things available and resources available by which one can enrich their self-esteem and feel hopeful. I know that because I looked for them desperately. I know that. You know, I looked for that.
And you, when I heard your story, because initially I heard your story over a year ago when I saw the clip from your website. You had a different picture in your profile at that time, and I was so caught up in your story, and I thought of what Michael Beckwith said in The Secret, which was one of those powerful lines was, out of nothing, out of no way, there comes a way. And
that's right.
You've
that's
found
right.
it. You found it.
That's right. I went to school with his brother. Yeah, I know him. I went to school with his brother, Michael Beckwith's brother.
Wow.
Yeah, and that's the honest to God truth, you know. I mean, sometimes selfishness blinds us. Not the selfishness that other people recognize, the selfishness that you can't escape from when you're sitting by yourself, you know, obsessing on a certain outcome. That kind of selfishness can block you. And I just said to myself, you know what, man, you got to check. Every time you act outwardly in any so-called good intent, check your motive, because you want the intent to be pure. I have to check my motive to make sure that my intent is pure, because I don't control the other person's reactions to it. I wrote a poem called I Don't Know Why, and I wrote it because I was out here in the Bay Area trying to do good things, trying to support other artists, doing things financially, resourcefully, and they were still trying to haggle with me like in this hip, slick, cool thing. And so I'm sitting there perplexed going, you don't got to hustle for this. This is being offered. And then I realized that a person could get so caught up in the me, comparing, they can get so caught up in that they can't even see a gift of grace being handed to them. Because, see, I know the gift is in the giving. See, I know that. So I'm already paid by giving unconditionally. I already know I'm paid. Anything after that is extra.
Yeah. Man, how many times have we talked about this in different ways, too? Because, you know, just mentioning that the secret, that's a big thing. To know what your gift is, and to be able to share that with other people and realize that nothing that anyone has, no way can anybody infringe on that gift, because that was just given to you. It has nothing to do with anybody else's. And once you come to that realization, oh, my God, it frees you from everything. It just reprioritizes your life. Well, who am I talking to? I mean, you're the guy who was eating food off of other people's plates because that's what you needed to do to survive. So your entire scope of being changed from that. How did you get to that point, Norman? Because I know the story, but other people don't.
Well, what happened for me is I did not surrender to anger. And what I, like I said, I had self-seeking motives, and I had a story of what I thought and how people should act. And I got really, really angry. I was here in the Bay Area, and I had an inner-city slick life. You know, like I said, nothing unique but the way I tell it. But, you know, inner-city hustle, that kind of thing. But I always wanted to play basketball. I always wanted to go to a prom. I always wanted to do all those regular teenage stuff. But I was a successful street hustler. But it wasn't the fiber of my character that had been cultivated by my father. It wasn't that. So the conflict of those two things didn't mesh. And so I got a job. I've always worked. And I went to college, and then I was working at a law firm. I'm 7 years college educated, and so I'm working at this law firm, and I'm seeing people say things to me like, "Hey, Norm," and you know they see me and they start talking about the negative stuff. And I just got really fed up with the Bay Area, so I decided to move to Seattle. By the time I got to Seattle, the minute somebody looked at me with any reference to a hip, slick, and cool persona, it really pissed me off, and then I became a victim. I became a victim of what I considered to be people's prejudices. Nobody saw the good in me, and it just ended up being this endless spiral. And then I said, well, you know, I guess I need to just go back to what I was doing, because nobody's going to give me a fair chance to see me in a fair perspective anyway. Now, the sad part about all that, the seed that planted that outward aggression, which I truly believe, is that when people experience the trauma in the early part of their lives, they set into motion this need to survive and connect dots that make them feel somewhat normal. My mother left my father with 5 kids. So my inadequate self-image started early. So what I did is I got with other broken kids, and we just kind of carried on like broken kids do, and self-manifested in various ways is what we end up being. So what you do as a child, you may do as a teen, you may do as a young adult until somebody comes along and corrects it. So it becomes a survival to connect the dots. And so my dots couldn't be corrected because I was too busy blaming people and not being accountable for my own well-being. So I didn't really have the ability to be responsible because I wanted other people to show me that they recognized my intent. They didn't do that. I got really angry, and I start finger-pointing, and I moved to Seattle, and before I knew it, I was drinking, I was angry, I was leering at people, and I just ended up on a spiral of self-destruction, which made me feel that I didn't matter, no one would hear me, and so forth. I mean, there's more to it. We don't have enough time, but it's just about making choices and not being able to withstand the consequences of the wrong choice. And it just beat me down. And, it just really, really beat me down. And so I ended up out there. Yeah.
Norman, you had something else, because I remember that interview that I saw. I was so immersed. You had an interview with somebody on a local TV scenario, I guess, in California, and the female interviewer, I was a little bit worried about her because she seemed as though she was on shaky ground, and you were a lot stronger than her, but she was asking you questions, and, you know, I was so caught up, I felt so badly, because part of the scenario of you becoming homeless was that you trusted a friend to sort of take care of you, to be roommates. So
did you feel abandoned by that guy, too?
So you had your mom and then this friend.
Well, that's what I was saying about the impact of a traumatic event in one's life. We need to stop judging the validity of someone's trauma and interject compassion to hear the pain. See, and so I did go up there with a guy who was my best friend since I was in kindergarten. He left me for a woman. And then I had a hotel. The money ran out. I got my last check from the law firm. The money ran out, and I just got barbaric. When the pressure's on, you get to see who's capable of displaying grace under pressure. And in more cases than few, we don't do that well. So I got betrayed. So I was trying to survive with a broken heart. How do you survive with a broken heart? There's two things that people do when they're in an uncomfortable place. They either repress the feelings or they try to escape them. And so I chose escape and repression. So the anger was fouling up, but I accepted the temporary relief of drugs and alcohol. I'm not ashamed to talk about the drugs and alcohol, but I don't wave it like a flag that expects you to play a violin. I'm very accountable for the decisions I made. It's part of your story,
you know, plain and simple.
I took the temporary relief, and I called myself regrouping, but I said, this unaccountability, this relaxation, no responsibility, I could just rest for a minute. And then, as you know, the relief from pain becomes addictive. And then we become addicted to that little temporary pain, relief of pain that we feel. And that came to a halt. I mean, I did not want to live. So what happened when I was homeless, I used to sleep in the bushes at St. James Cathedral in Seattle. And I had had early religious training, so I had slipped into a state of dementia, actually. And I thought to myself, well, a church, they say a church is a house of God. So if I sleep in, and I used to say this four times a night. I said, if I sleep in his yard, maybe he'll see me. If I sleep in his yard, maybe he'll hear me. If I sleep in his yard, maybe he'll help me. I used to say that all the time.
Aww.
And it rains a lot in Seattle, so I got really sick and almost died of pneumonia. So I'd love to sit here and tell you that the clouds opened up in the sky, but what had happened instead of that was I ended up in Pioneer Square living in a mission. I lived in Union Gospel Mission, a Lutheran Compass Mission, $3.25 a night for a bed, $1.50 for a locker, and $2.50 a day for a meal. And I lived there, and I once again, my son, well, at this point in time, I had a son. I used to carry, and I'll wrap this up really quick. I had a broken, this raggedy picture of my son Dustin. And so what I did was I looked at the picture and I said, one more try. I said, God, I need one more try. I think I could do it one more time. So I ended up applying for a job at about 13 temporary agencies throughout Seattle, and I got a job handing out flyers to a woman's shoe store, and I had a resume. And so when the ladies would say, "Why are you handing out flyers to a woman's shoe store?" I'd go, "Why are they hiring you if they're where you are?" And they'd go,
"Wait, say that again. I didn't hear that last part. What?"
They would ask me, "Why was I handing out flyers to a woman's shoe store?" And I go, "Are they hiring over there where you are?" And they say, "Yeah, you got a resume?" And so I have a resume. So it was just a temporary job, and so I'd hand out resumes to the women that were curious about why I was handing out these flyers, because nobody wanted this job at the shoe store, at the temporary agency. So what ended up happening is I got $30 that day. I went to St. Vincent de Paul, and you're going to laugh at this, but this will be give you an image of where my self-esteem was. I get my little $30. I go to St. Vincent de Paul. I buy a pair of slacks. I buy a shirt that has someone else's initials on it, because I'm thinking if they put initials on it, that must mean it's a good shirt. That's where my self-esteem was. So I buy this shirt. But now this is the funny part. Okay, listeners, don't laugh too hard. I bought this tie. It was a Pierre Cardin tie, the first designer out there. And it was a fat tie. It was about 4 inches wide. It had the big old Omega on it, and it was a big Bozo the Clown tie. But it represented a handful of self-esteem for me, and I was proud with my little fat Bozo the Clown tie.
Oh my God! It really had Bozo the Clown on it.
No, I thought it was a Bozo the Clown tie because it was so fat. It was so fat. So I buy this tie, right? And so now my esteem is pretty well. I got a handful. And that's why I was saying to you earlier that I know what you can do with a handful, because I lived it. And I had my little $30 outfit, you know, my little shirt with somebody else's initials, and my little chest poked up a little bit, even got a little plastic cover for my son's picture. I was back. So I moved back to the Bay Area. I moved back here to the Bay Area, Berkeley, Oakland. And unfortunately, about 5 months after my father was really glad to see me, because he really had worried about me. And I say this in the film. He said that I really thought I was going to pick up a newspaper and see another black youth shot and see your name. And he was so happy. He was so happy to see me. And then 5 months later, he passed away. He died. So that's when my drinking and self-destruction went on a mad run, and for 2.5 years, and after that I cleaned up my act, because it just wasn't my time. So I mean, like I said, I'm not trying to give the impression that my struggles are so unique, but I really know what I'm saying from the heart can reach a heart. And as I said on that program that you were talking about, I told the lady on that program, I said, I write poetry for the person who's sitting at home with a gun in their mouth, wondering why they should care. Mm-hmm. And she asked me, what would you say to them? I said, don't get it twisted, sweetheart. There's no pat answer for that. I said, but the first thing I would want to find out is what matters to them.
Yeah.
Because that's one of the things we ignore. We don't give time to see what matters to an individual. Because everybody has seen solution, Trish. Everyone has seen solution. They may have lost grip, or they might have saw it as a passing thing. But everybody consciously has seen possibility. And I believe that. And I'm dedicating my life to giving, I call it the 10-minute program. You have 10 minutes to somebody to make them feel like a human being. The odds that you plug into their humanity are great. I'm not saying bring them home and feed them. I'm just saying sometimes when you give somebody 10 minutes, you may be a conduit for that individual to reflect on their own humanity. I wrote a poem about that called What Comes from the Mouth of a Fool. I wrote it for a guy that I met on the streets of San Francisco who said he was bothering me when he was panhandling me. And I said, you're not bothering me, because I was feeling upset. I ended up talking to this guy, and I said, let me buy you something to eat, man, because I'm feeling funky. And he said, oh, man, I didn't mean to bother you. I said, look, man, let me buy you something to eat.
Oh, man.
This conversation revealed to me that he was one of the first African Americans to fly Air Force One. This guy, I can't remember the president, but then I looked at him differently, and I saw this Air Force coat, saw the slits on his eyes, and my soul wouldn't rest. So I went home, and I wrote a poem called What Comes from the Mouth of a Fool. So these are the kind of experiences that I open myself up to, and that's why I do talk a lot, because I'm always passing information that I think would be useful for somebody who I have a heart connection to. So I know what 10 minutes can do. That man saved me. I met a hero because I gave him 10 minutes to feel like a human being.
Once again have touched a nerve in what people's consciousness is all about, because people are in varying stages of understanding that. How many times have we been in a scenario where we're in a room and we're all pretty much ADD to a certain extent, but you really have brought to the surface in the time that I've known you what people do when they're talking one-to-one with somebody who really wants to talk to you in a crowded room where maybe there's a party going on, maybe there's a conference, and you can always tell who's really listening to you. Because when you're speaking to someone, their eye is always on the door to see who else is coming in that might be better to talk to than you.
Oh, yeah. I learned that in L.A. I mean, I got trained. I was in the music industry for 24 years. And one of the guys that taught me, he said, Norman, when they look at their watch, you ain't hitting. And he said, remember that. When they look at their watch, when you're in a meeting and somebody looks at their watch, you got to be conscious. You got to be present. But, you know, like I said, you know, and I'll let you finish saying what you were saying, but the truth of the fact also, too, in my experience, Trish, is that it only takes no more than a minute to pass on grace. It really does. It doesn't take more than a minute to, I mean, a smile that's sincere, not a I'm afraid of you that you're going to rob me smile, not that kind, not the disarming one, but a smile of genuine acknowledgement. I know for a fact from practical application, I know that it can make a difference. I know that, and I'm committed. That's why I said the inside tribe of PWC, those who care, I invite the world to spare 10 minutes with somebody that is experiencing a less than advantageous circumstance, then 10 minutes with them. That's all I ask. Now, if you got a good reason, I'd love to hear it, but you can't spare 10 minutes.
Right. Yeah. You know what? That's a gift that you just gave a whole lot of people for Christmas to rethink that, because we're going to see in the comings and goings of shopping that we're going to wrap up that we also take for granted. We're going to go by people. My son just told me the other day that he and his dad went to a part of town they don't ordinarily go to, but they wanted to explore a store or so. And he said that he saw a couple of ladies. They were asking for cigarettes, but he knew that they were asking for more than that. People are just real needy, and they don't even know how to ask anymore. They just are so empty that man who said to you, I can't believe you said, I hope I'm not bothering you, that kills me, because I heard that story a couple of times now. And I think to myself, what kind of lack of self-esteem was in his spirit to get to the point where he felt like he wasn't worthy to speak to you?
And he gave me a gift, because now, and for your listeners and stuff, trust me, I'm not saying that everybody, you know, you do this with everybody. You can trust your instincts. But he gave me, I thought I was going through stuff. I was so pissed off. And he felt like he was bothering me, and he gave me a greater gift enough to write a poem. I don't write gimmick poems. My poems come from my soul. I don't write cool poems to be on some kind of spoken word show and stuff. I don't do that. I write poems that I could revisit to remind me about the richness and the blessings that I've been fortunate to receive. These are life bookmarks for me. I read some of my poems and go, did I write that? oh, where was I at when I wrote that? You know?
Yeah.
I have to benchmark. I have to benchmark moments of clarity that my life has presented to me, and I have to celebrate the fact that I'm able to return to those moments through a poem. I mean, I'm a Langston Hughes kind of poet. I use simple words. My vibe is I use simple words. Sometimes I use some bigger words, but, you know, I just go with it. But for the most part, it's really about how effective do I want to be in my attempts to communicate something significant. Lower the bar, Norman, if it gets too complicated. If somebody gets lost in a concept, break it down, because that means they're interested. So it's all about being conscious and paying attention, you know.
That's really important. And I wanted to play another piece. Of course, I played Discovery right before you checked in via the phone.
Okay.
Can I play Remembrance now?
That piece, Remembrance, I dedicate that. That was written for my mom and my dad, who I lost. But I also have to say this with that poem. I want listeners to know that that poem is not just for my mom or my dad. That poem is for anyone out there who has lost someone dear to them, to be a reminder that a loving memory of them will keep them alive in your heart. There it is.
I love that. This is Inside, also known as Norman Woods, and this is Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy. Really getting hybrid today.
Memory of you is fading fast. You, my memory of strength, I am longing to hold on to. Soaring free, my memory that saves me from despair. My memory is golden grain, food for thought. With the hungry, I will share. You, my memory that unlocks the burdens of bad dreams through enlightened opportunities. I can build you any way I want to in my imagination. If I choose not to share you with no others, I can't be forced. My memory I will protect from those who grieve with deceit. A love that's not true. But fewer words are spoken by the outsiders who were never fortunate enough to be refreshed or have thirst quenched by your knowledge. From memory seizures, I gasp for air. I can't breathe as though my throat has been filled with sand. While other memories run through my mind like impalas, struggling their way across a dry Mother Africa land. And even their pain does not have the power to diminish a job so very well done from beginning and so sadly was not finished. Because you are the memory, strong, sturdy, and duty-bound. So well informed with ways to love, ringing loud in spirit sound. My Gibraltar, so hard my memory, still firm and so rock steady. The door of my mind opens to take me to you. So glad I know. It's always ready.
So beautiful. Oh my gosh. From Curator in the Community, that's Inside, aka Norman Woods, Remembrance. And Norman, it just is so fascinating to me, having listened to so much of your work now in the past couple of weeks. How did you find these musicians to coincide with inflection, the vibe of who you are. How did that happen?
Well, like I said, I've been in the music industry for a long time. I did promotion. I worked for a couple of producers. I did management. I managed a few artists. And like I said, I had a small record label and so such. What I did is I sought out certain musicians, and I went and seen their performance, and I didn't let them know I was there. So I had seen them 3 or 4 times prior to. I listened to their interviews. And then I had a round robin thing where I had some guys just come and jam at a freeform jam, and I just watched them get in there and do their thing. But the 3 people, I actually sought them out and studied them and watched how they deal with venue people. I watched how they talk to other musicians. I had a whole, it sounds really business organized, but I'm one of those people who believe in effective organization. And so I really kind of knew what I wanted. Had certain artists that I had admired, my own, and so I kind of like auditioned them, and I told them, I said, if you want to treat this like a gig, give me your number and I'll call you later. If you want to treat this like an opportunity to express your love for jazz, I believe that I can create an environment by which you can do that, and here's my plan, you know, and so forth. This is what I'm trying to do. I'm not going to micromanage you. I'm not going to treat you like an abusive club owner. I'm going to treat you like a man or a woman with respect and integrity. That's how I'm going to do it. Because I came too far to treat anybody less than anything short of that.
Oh, yeah.
From what I had been through. I mean, that's one thing about when your heart is stomped on and trampled and your hope is lost and your spirit is depleted. The one thing you adamantly commit yourself to is to minimize your engagement in any activity that would give somebody else that feeling. So I know that jazz guys are not paid much. They play out of the jar. And I said, look here, I'm going to pay you the way you should be paid, best I can afford, not put myself out of pocket. All I want you to do is give me a potential experience that reflects your love of jazz. Because when I start doing my poetry, I ain't going to be thinking about you. But I already know where my poetry comes from.
Right.
It comes from my soul. So once I get started, you just need to hold yours. And when I first did my first piece, they kind of saw I was serious. They saw that I wasn't trying to be some kind of old reinvented rapper, you know, slam poet. They saw that I wasn't doing that. Because as I said to you, and I don't mean to be redundant, my words are my cure. My words are my soul nurturing. So I'm not playing around. I have poems that don't have music to them yet. But they need to know I was serious. So I said, if you want to treat this like a gig, give me your number and I'll holler at you later. If you want to be a part of something that may be just as good for you as it is for me, let's do this. You know? So I got, like I said, I just hired my drummer. He's 73 years old. He's been playing jazz drums for over 60 years. Kirkhoff has been playing for 50 years. So forth. Mandy Flowers studied with Ray Brown and Charlie Hayden and graduated from Berklee School of Music. And Mark Wright went to the University of Pacifica, but he's played with Harley White and a lot of very prominent jazz people, Al Tanner, Smiley Winters. I mean, you know, these guys got the chops, you know, and I treat them like adults. And so the benefit ends up being mine. They hear my poetry, and they elevate with the sincerity that I try to make it there.
Oh, they sure do. They make, I mean, your words are so powerful. And as I was telling my son yesterday, because T had that really cool thing happen to him in creative writing where he got validation for what he had written. And I had said to him, and I had you in mind, I said, you know, the important thing when I read your writing is that, and it's small potatoes, Norman, when I say this, because you've been through so much that it almost doesn't matter. But for T, 19 years old and in community college, it does. I said, you don't write words that are trite. There are some people who think that their creativity is such that it's going to set the world on fire, but they're actually saying the same thing that a whole lot of other people have said. And they don't say it the same way that other people who originated the thought did. You, you have blown the clouds away from all of that so much. You have this way of getting very personal about your experience, but it's such a personal experience that it begs somebody to get involved and to make sure that they go into their own soul and find out the truth about who they really are, as opposed to the facade that they keep trying to force on people. That's what I love
right.
about what you do. You make people get rid of the BS and the baggage that's in their life and get to who they really are.
Yeah, well, because it saved my life, Trish. It saved my life, and contrary to what people may believe, I had like 12 or 13 voices of self-destruction in my head on a daily basis. And all of a sudden, one day, and I'm not trying to get too spiritual, but I heard a voice that said, ignore everything, Norman, follow me. Call it divine intuition or whatever you want to call it. And I think we all hear those divine voices of intuition on some form or fashion, whether you're atheist, religious, or spiritual. You hear something that has a no BS tone to it, and you know it's a heart message.
Yeah.
I followed my heart message, and I said, look, I'm going to change this negative, repressive narrative, and I'm going to create a new dialogue and see what happens. And I was a screenwriter before. How I got into poetry was I left the Fortune 500 thing. I've had three businesses. I've had six figures. I've had all that, and I've had nothing. And I decided that I didn't want to live a life of regret. So I wrote a screenplay about my father, about that experience that I was telling you guys earlier. I wrote a screenplay about that, and I went to a major studio in Los Angeles, whose name I will not mention because it doesn't need to be to make the point, and they red-pinned my script so bad and tried to make my story about the intimate love between a father and son so Jefferson Good Time slapstick that I walked out of the studio, and I was on a street in Los Angeles, and I'm not going to say the street because you know the studio, but I'm sitting out there looking like Steve Martin did in The Jerk. I felt like my pants were down. They weren't, but it just kind of just using it symbolically, but I was like The Jerk. I didn't know what had happened. I wrote a poem about a guy talking to his spiritual source of divinity. And that was my first poem. And at that point in time, what I felt by listening to the positive reflection of my intuition, things changed. I didn't know that the dialogue was going to change. So then the dialogue changed from sentence to paragraph. And it all started with one word, possibility. Then the next word became hope. And then the next word became perseverance. And so those three words start introducing me to positive affirmation constructed sentences. And guess, lo and behold, the dialogue changed. Now, this is something that we all experience. But when we compare ourselves to other people's situation, we forget that we're getting these seeds of well-constructed positive affirmations that if we give them time, they will take form and consolidate a sense of well-being within possibility. I know that for a fact because it happened to me. So when I write a poem from my heart. I mean, I might mispronounce a word like Gibraltar or Gibraltar, but you know what? When you're in the heart realm, people not doing an English test. They're like
right.
going, yeah, I feel that too. I got an email from a lady in Normandy that heard a poem of mine called The Tribe where all of my band members get to do solos. She wrote an email and said that part of that poem where you said, do you think we can do this? No. Do you really think we can do this? That was what she got out of the poem. And I said, you know what? I'm going to keep doing this. If people can get one little phrase out of my work that enriches their positive optimism, then I've done my job. Because my job is about creating dialogue. Solutions
right.
are born through dialogue, and so are teachers. So if I can get people talking, then I let the grace and the blessing take over.
Well, it's just mind-blowing that you are this messenger that has had nothing and then everything. I'm just still trying to wrap my head around somebody who was sleeping in church bushes and then got to make six figures and taking care of these people who are supporting your efforts as you try to speak life when you play these different functions. I mean, I've seen you do your thing live in the way of film, because, of course, we've never met in person, and I've heard what you've had to say. It's just wild to me how God can make use of so many different kinds of people to get the word out that their life has meaning. It trips me out.
Well, I think also, too, that what I try to keep in mind is that we all have soft spots from our scars. And so sometimes if the scar doesn't heal, a soft spot remains, and sometimes you might get into a challenging situation where somebody might hit your soft spot, and then you might feel incapable of connecting those dots. And so you know, we got to keep going. We got to keep going and keeping on. I just wanted to say thank you to you because of our dialogue, I haven't performed in a while. I haven't released any albums. I have six albums here that have not even been released yet. And I got really, really tired. And so when we started talking, our conversations are an example of what we're talking about, because I recorded a CD for all of my Facebook fans, still loving it, you know, still loving the art of it. It's dedicated to all the people who were so kind to me on Facebook. I just put all my work out there on Facebook one time. I do this thing where I get so up against the wall and I go, either you're going to fall, turn into sand on me and blow away, or you're going to make one last stab. And so I just shot all my work out there on Facebook, and I just had a rebirth. Now, I've done that two other times in my life. I did that when I did this album called Jazz Opera and Broke Brother Trying to Come Up. We talked about that yesterday.
Yeah.
And I was just ready to just quit, saying there's no place for me. I'm not doing aggressive poetry. I'm just this passive voice poet who wants to be invited safely into your living room. I'm not going to get angry. I'm not going to do this outward aggression stuff. That's not my thing, because anger is a lonely place. It takes courage to not be angry. So I've already demonstrated courage to not be angry anymore. And I'm writing this stuff, and nobody was getting me. And I said, well, I'm just going to make my sound. I'm going to do something that's really jazzy, and then I'm going to do something that's really commercial. And I sold my car. I had a Lexus. I sold my Lexus to produce two albums. And I just said, yeah, I'm just going to do this. I'm just going to do this. So I know that within all of us, there is a capability of connecting those dots if we sit still in the present, if we pay attention to the people who love us, if we receive their loving intent. These are things that I've done. So I'm talking too much, so I'm going to be quiet and let you talk some more.
No.
I'm serious about this. This is my life work. This is what I do.
It's your ministry, and you
right.
Can't have that stressed to you enough. This is your ministry.
I told you yesterday, listeners, I told Trish yesterday that there were three things that I know how to do. I might not do a lot of stuff right, but there are three things that I know how to do. One, I know how to be a good friend. Two, I know how to care. I know how to care. And the third thing is I know how to inspire. And I know how to do those things. So when I talk to somebody with enthusiasm and sincerity, trust me, you can take it to the bank. I don't do stuff that I can't deliver. I don't talk stuff that people can get into an argument with, because I don't argue. Arguments are irrelevant flexing of middle testosterone that I don't engage in.
Well, look, folks have to know that there is this other side that really piques my interest, too, because – you know, Norman, we know each other to a certain extent, but you don't know my background about the different folks that I have worked for in the way of radio and have made it a point to make them money. But I didn't see a whole lot of that, but they sure made use of me. Now, keep that thought and keep in mind that, and Norman, folks might be younger and not know this, but back in the day, in the 50s and early 60s, there was just this array of different kinds of jazz endeavors at these little clubs, and there would be jazz played in the back, whether it was in time to what people wanted to say or not. But these beat poets were just a part of the culture. A lot of them, of course, were in California. And Norman, you are such a throwback to them, not only because the beauty and the honesty of what you're saying, but you know what else is there? There's also that you're going to tell it like a T-I-Z, and if it hurts, so be it. So be it. It just has to come forth. So, of course.
They'll survive. They'll survive. They'll
right.
survive. Because, like I said, if it comes from the heart, the prickly feelings that they feel, the pinching and the discomfort, it's going to pass because it's going to the heart. So sometimes things have to go through the thorns to get to the garden. So as long as there's love in it, you know, I realize two things. The journey starts with hope, but it ends with compassion. So when I send something out there, a person might get a little upset about it for a minute, but when they calm down, they'll see that there's love in it. My son taught me that 2 days ago. He sent me a text because he was really angry at me because he said, "You're so concerned with how people see, how I see you. Nobody's going to remember you as an alcoholic, thug, criminal, homeless guy, dad, you know, and I look forward to the day that our relationship can exist beyond your insecurity." And I said, whoa.
Now, wait a minute. You got fuzzy in that last part of that, and that's important what your son said because, like, maybe you turned the phone or something. Say that again, Norman,
my son,
what he said to you.
Can you hear me? My
yep.
son said to me, he said, "Dad, nobody's going to remember you." We had these headbutting sessions, he and I. I love him to death, as you know. And
yep.
He said to me, he said, "Dad, nobody's going to remember you as a violent, thug, alcoholic, homeless person." And he said, "Nobody's going to remember you for that. And I look forward to the day that our relationship can evolve past your insecurities."
Woo!
And you know what? And I taught him that. And I'm like going, I guess you asked for something, but your responsibility is to see when it comes back at you. So I just said, "Yes, indeed." I said, "Yes, indeed." And I said, "Okay." And so I thought about that, and I said to myself, "Okay, Norman, okay. Keep it, you know." And like I said, you know, the thing with the poetry and the throwback and the jazz thing, like, my mom was really into, you know, she was a vocalist. And I think I told you the other day that my godfather was, When my uncle had a club called Callaway's in West Oakland, and all the jazz guys from the East Coast, when they'd come out here, they'd come to his club. And so when my mother was pregnant with me, my sister had told me who my godfather was. And I'm like, going, "Who?" And she said, "This guy, his name is Illinois Jacket. And she's like, and I said, "Illinois Jacket?" She said, "Yes." He said, "That's your godfather."
One of the coolest cats in Chicago ever.
And the reason why I share this with you is because I now understand why my mother bought me a saxophone. And my first song that I tried to play was Stanley Turrentine's "Sugar." I tried to play that. So I just have that connection. I was just saying that I have that connection. That's part of my connection of jazz as a landmark sound for me, not to take anything away from anything else, and that my cousin in Philadelphia, my family is in Philadelphia and Chicago, and my cousin, Robert Miller, he shows me a picture of a band he had and shows me this little guy in a military outfit, and I said, "That dude looks familiar." He said, "Yeah, that's Grover Washington." So my cousin had a band, and Grover Washington was in my cousin's band when he was 20-something when he had got back from the military. They used to call him Sarge. My cousin told me this whole deal about Grover Washington and him. So I have people who have let me know that I've been the recipient of a very spiritually rich lineage, even if it's just through an experience or if it's through dialogue or anything. And I really, really want to emphasize to all of those who seek comfort and confidence and inspiration, it's in your lineage. Think about those people you've met. Think about those cards that were sent to you. Think about that person who hugged you and you weren't available to understand why, but they just felt like hugging you. I'm not being airy-fairy. I'm being very serious because I'm telling you, they're there. They are there. So, I mean, you know, I'm going to do my part. Trust me. I may not have no money now. I mean, with you getting my interest back going and the people from Facebook, that's why I did that CD. I said, I'm doing this CD to say thank you to all those Facebook people who were generous with their compliments. You know, I meet friends in your chat room, you know, Zelda, Debbie Poole, and Matt and them. And, you know, I mean, my heart has grown about a half an inch in its diameter. It's gotten bigger. It's gotten bigger. So it's just my way of saying thank you. You know, the gift is in the giving, and you guys have been really nice to me.
Well, speaking of Griselda, she just said in the chat room, as you saw, you keep talking, hon.
No, I was a host to guide this, so I'm just going to try to draw back a little more while we got a little bit of time. But
no,
I think you're an excellent host. So I feel this is so cool to me. I have no idea what I'm feeling and what I'm supposed to do next. All I know is that somebody hears me, and there's other people that would like to have that feeling, and they can know that I am committed from day one to day none to make sure that I will continue to speak for the disregarded voices of the unheard. You can take that to the bank.
I know that's right. That is something that I would stake my life on, the sincerity of what you've just said, to be sure. And I want to take folks back to what we were talking about just a couple of minutes ago about the kinds of truth that need to get out there. Some folks are going to relate to this a whole lot. Some may not. But the basic tenet of this song is something that you can put into your head in another kind of capacity and go, oh, yeah, oh, yes. So you'll understand when you hear Norman, a.k.a. Inside, when you hear him do this Vanguard Dreams track from Jazz
Vanguard
Opera.
Vanguard Dreams from the Jazz Opera. Oh,
yes.
Yeah. That was, oh, yeah. I'm going to
oh,
be clapping this with that one.
You know that you're going to hear this track on this show. Come on now. All right.
That's
and
the,
I see that Mr. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, that's the one, this track is the one where the producer kind of dropped his mouth. He said, I've never seen a poet keep up with Sonny Simmons on the saxophone.
Man, that's something. That's pretty huge, and so is this. This is almost 5 minutes long, so get ready for this. This is Inside on Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy.
Now, Sunrise, for instance, he doesn't depend on the public at all. He doesn't even care about the public, right? Because he's producing, if you like him. A lot of people scare a lot of people.
I have a dream, but sometimes it feels like a nightmare filled with endless confusion. Sleeping Beauty wasn't the only one who needed to be awakened by love. We're about to become unlikely characters involved with an intense drama with tricks that justify a systematic destruction of habits which are consistent with growth. The recipients of special privilege turn away, hoping I will adopt the basic premise that my community is no more than an urban rustic culture where tolerance is wasted, enabling a chronically dysfunctional lifestyle. My street corner testimonials reflect traditional patterns and oral narratives from Sidewalk City. That's my fame and glory. And I wasn't interested in buying the book, but inside, desperately, I wanted to change the story. It came to me right there, in that moment, why I had to leave. I was dying. I had to learn and read and write. Came back home for a visit, educated. My partners, they laughed with contempt. Man, who is this dude? said I was talking like I was white.
Inside, throw me a dollar, man, to get a taste of something. You know, call it alcohol or wine. Come on, man, how you gonna act?
Well, the true value of this free mind is to remember how important it is to share my notes with those stuck in sad role reversals where the father is a dope fiend and his son supplied to heroin or crack. So tell me who's got the answer when it comes to freeing one's mind from the confinements of a poverty-stricken identity. My change isn't unique, but it's mine. Still, it was harder than it seemed. Man, I'm tired. Can a black man get some love while still waiting for a dream? Subsidized poison mentals blur my vision. No freedom to think. Fear from the need to reassess elusive goals. Stuck, I still remain a sleeper. With faith that those who live lives will congregate with ways for me to grow. Sharing, maybe lift me so that I can create a desire for something much deeper. And I wonder, who makes the rules for rescue? Media hypnosis still try to induce me into believing that my efforts will always be seen as suburban brothers' homecoming. Hidden agenda, proceed with caution, prepare your rage. Distrust him with criticism and static. But if so, who will tell cousin Victor 10 years have passed? He's still single, 57, at home with mama living in the attic. And don't forget to wipe the drool from his face. Once my anger had society concerned, but now it has everybody chasing mad hip-hop dollars. Holla, but hide the pain. Holla, when falling into a retrogressive groove. Struggle used to be a language we once shared. You, not me, have become a citizen of Babylon. No dialogue, we are separated by walls of confusion. Tell me, if you fall, will you be able to tell who is friend or foe? Moving with caution, I have lightened my load of guilt. I can't afford to carry any more on my back. Petty hustles never worked before, nor did attempts to impress. I guess that's why I left them on the track. Now standing alone, reflecting on yesterday's dreams, with just a spark of memory, re-energized by a fist held high, I changed my attitude like I was doing the world a favor. What was once known as coffee black pride, MTV has oversaturated our minds with cream. Comprehension supplied by Clear Channel has now changed the entire flavor. On the edge, I still don't need to say F you, MF, N-word, or back up before I smack you. I have grown a lot, matured a little, but be careful because if you provoke me, I can still outblack you. Thank goodness I am not confused about who needs my help and how to help them. Who said bringing back solution was going to be easy? You and I know that some things are hard to change. But just don't underestimate what passive voices say. There just might be more to understand than it might seem. Patience running thin for some of us, but me, I'm just a broke brother trying to come up, sharing a few notes of hope while still waiting for a dream. I never knew self-esteem must include all the skills most essential when you deal with the changing of the gods.
Woo, Lord, have mercy. Ow, that hit me right between the eyes. Inside, Norman Woods with us, and that was Vanguard Dreams from Jazz Opera. Man alive.
I love that poem.
I
love that poem. I love it. I'm sorry. It's not in an envious way. You know why I love that poem, Trish? Because I wrote that poem because I was really confused about how you progress and turn around and help someone else. And so I wrote that piece and I said, you know, about cousin Victor, you know, who is, you know, mentally challenged and living with mama, and nobody says anything at the picnic. Everybody just gives him love and it's all cool. And if you make progress and you get strong and you come back and you have to fight walls of envy and people thinking because you're educated, you're trying to be white and all of these things, it's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking when people go beyond racism. It's heartbreaking when people step out of the male role system that's so one-sided that it doesn't really accommodate needs that need to be addressed. I went home and I got jumped by 7 young kids on a bus in my hometown, because I live in a county, a very affluent county, and I said, oh, I don't belong in this county and all this stuff. until I go back home thinking I'm going to get that home love, and I get jumped by six young kids on a bus. And I was so heartbroken because I was angry at first, and then I'm looking at these kids, and I'm like going, they're Dustin's age. They're my son's age. So how can you be mad and want to show them who they're messing with, and then you see their children? And so I said, there is a big, you know, and then I saw guys on the corner that I grew up with. They wanted a couple of dollars for wine and stuff, and I'm trying to feel the heart of the hood, and I'm like, wait a minute. There's something really wrong here, you know, and it just was hard. And so I had to write, you know, Still Waiting for the Dream, to let them know that even though they didn't feel my hug or hear my touch, my care, that I'm going to write a poem that lets the universe know that there's still some souls waiting to be rescued, even though at that moment in time I didn't have what I needed to give them. But I wrote a poem about it. Here you go.
And you know what? It's so funny because, oh, my God, this is true. I promise you it's true. This has never happened. You know, you're into this poem, and I'm into it, and I'm watching people in the chat room, and there's been a little bit back and forth about, oh, Norman's deep. Oh, I'm loving this. And At the moment that you said clear channel, a spider walked across my floor.
Whoa.
Yes. This was a big, fat spider came out of nowhere. I guess one of the screens must be open in the front, but I freaked. I got back on the microphone within seconds, and I thought, isn't that interesting? How right that is to see a spider at the mention of clear channel.
Yes. We get little messages. You just never know where the message is going to come from.
You know what? It's the butterfly effect. You got to pay attention to everything, because everything that happens in a given day affects everything else.
Yes. Yeah. So, yeah. So I love that poem because it really, I caught it. You know, sometimes I catch poems and I catch them, and I'm able to write a lot of them. And then some of them I'll write, like, I'll write a verse or two. But that one was like, man, I'm trying to do this loving thing. So you can turn frustration into an asset. You can turn
Absolutely.
Frustration into a determination. You know, and I'm like, you know, and I told the guys on the corner, I said, look here, man. I said, don't get it twisted, Chief. I said, the only difference between your situation and mine is that I caught the Hope bus. And I refused to get off at the end of the line. I told him I'm going to ride the bus back and forth until I feel confident enough to get off. I said, I just got my ride on the Hope bus. So, you know, and I did give him the money and stuff. And it wasn't like a better than thing. I mean, these are cats that just missed the bus, man. And I do that. I do that. That's what I do, because the gift is in the giving, as I said earlier. The gift is in the giving. Now, I'm practical, and of course I need to make money and stuff for that. But when all is said and done, like I told you, I sent you my work because in its initial conception, I had prayed and meditated and said, when all else fails, Norman, what will you be satisfied with? And it went beyond money. And it said that my work is in the hands of someone who cares. So on the way, I make money. On the way, I get notoriety. On the way. But at the end of the day, will it be possible for anything of value that I've created that is significant, will it be accessible? Well, it's only going to be accessible if it's in the hands of other people who care. So that's the goal. You know, that's the goal, you know. So, but I didn't know I was even going to be talking about my music. I've been getting calls from people who heard some of my stuff, and I'm a filmmaker, and getting these calls from people that say, oh, man, I heard your stuff, or I've seen the page and stuff, and it's just, there's no words that can describe the feelings that come through. But the one thing I'm doing is I'm embracing them. I'm celebrating them. I'm letting them be the ink in a new pen for a new chapter. And I'm ready to write some more poems. I'm ready to write.
And yay!
Like, this hasn't happened. This hasn't happened in 2.5 years. I'm ready to write something, and I can hear the poem, and I can hear the poem. It's going to be called Tone. because there's a tone. And I just know that's going to be the name of it. I don't care what to write it about. It's going to be called Tone.
It's going to be called what?
Know. Tone. T-O-N-E.
Tone.
Yeah, I don't know why, but it's just that name keeps going, Tone. Like, yes, Norman.
I like
regardless
it.
Of what you may think, regardless of what you think, Norman, my name is, my. I am a poem, and my name is Tone, and you are going to give me birth. So just deal with it. So I said, okay. So, you know, so what can I say? I could feel it, you know. I can feel it, you know. So, you know, I'm just trying to do my thing and make my mark and throw a little care out there. You know, like I told you before, you know, I'm not perfect, but that's not the goal. The goal is to take things that come across your path that will be of value to someone else and find the quickest, easiest way to get it to them and let grace be your pay, and that will encompass the tangibles and the intangibles. And you just have to maintain faith and keep the conduit open, you know, to receive it. So I'm just trying to do my thing, you know.
Well, look, you're not going to get the peace that is supposed to come in making sure that your gift is delivered to the right people if you turn your attention to something else. This is what you're supposed to be doing. You are supposed to be viewing this as a ministry and helping other people. You know, when you have these doubts of thinking, you know, I don't know, I think I should go back. What would you go back to? This is what you do that is beneficial to the universe. And to put it in the strongest terms, really.
Yeah.
Why
yeah.
were you?
I prayed and I meditated on being eligible for spiritual warriorship. And I prayed on it for weeks. And I meditated on it for weeks, almost a month. I prayed to be eligible for spiritual warriorship. So I try to take all these trials and tribulations and trials and errors and interplays that I am forgiving on myself, or I'm going to give, I take all of them as part of the training, you know, to not be threatened by the roller coaster ride of consequences I once was. Because before I was scared to do anything because I didn't know if I would withstand the consequences. But now that I'll experience the consequence, and so when I tell somebody else who's really threatened or intimidated by an anticipating consequence, I can tell them in a sincere way, you'll be able to survive it. And they'll look at me and they'll go, I believe you, man. I believe you. And I'll tell them, I'll go, you know, I have those moments too. Just like me, I have those things too. Just like you, I've planted seeds of aggression and I've diluted them. I did not allow the weeds of aggression to fester within me. I have pulled those weeds. And here's what happened, you know. This thing with my son, I just wanted to say, one of the great lessons with my son was I made tremendous sacrifices for my son, and my father made tremendous sacrifices for us. But my dad died before I said, how is life after a sacrifice? But with my son, what happened with my son, with this thing, what he was concerned about, as I said earlier, about the pasture insecurities and all that stuff, mm-hmm. when I prayed on that and meditated, why that didn't bother me and why it just sounded like it was a good thing to hear, what I realized is that I didn't learn life after sacrifice. See, I got that part from my dad, that you make sacrifices for your family and people you care for, but you don't necessarily get to expect a prize after this. And what I did is I said to myself, well, maybe something's going to come about that's going to show me why I did these sacrifices, why I did this. I sold my car to make a record that I thought was meaningful. I'm probably going to get something that's going to show me this is why you did it. Well, that's not always the case, Trish. You don't always get the thing that reaffirms why you did what you did, because sometimes the gift was in the process.
Yeah.
So my son, I apologized to him and made an amends to him and said, you know, the burden of my personal validation should not be put upon your shoulders, man. And I said, but my scars are deep because I learned to sacrifice, and I didn't know that you don't sit back waiting for something. I thought that you are supposed to go, something's going to come through and show you why you did that. And I take that example and I use it in my expectations of what I accomplish and do in this life. if I put it upon you to make me feel great, there's chances that I'm going to be disappointed because you're only obligated to your storyline, and it's an act of generosity when you step out of your storyline to help me. But I don't need to sit here waiting for it, even if it's my son. Even if it's my son. And I have two sons. One's quiet and sneaky, Dustin, my older one. Shalimar is. I love Shalimar so much. He's just a straight shooter. I was in Vancouver, and I'll end with this, but I just needed to say this, you know, an example of what I'm talking about. I'm in a restaurant in Vancouver, British Columbia, because my son's Canadian and African-American. And so we're in a restaurant, and I'm trying, the waitress is being nice to him. And then he's like going, Dad, I said, she kind of likes you, Shalimar. And then he goes, Dad, he said, I know as your son, and you being a guy, I know you want your son to be interested in having a girlfriend and stuff. He said, but I don't have a job. I don't have any money. I don't have any car. And I really don't think I have anything to share with her. And my mouth just dropped. This guy is 22 years old. And I said to him, I said, son, there's a lot of grown men that could probably learn a lot from you.
Yeah, right.
Those are my two sons. Dustin is a screenwriter. He's doing his thing. And as I said before in the earlier part of our conversation, I need to get out of my own way and see that all that my heart yearns from my children is being given to me. It just has a different form.
Yeah.
So I need to be a better listener. I need to listen to the style that's being shared with me and not invalidate it because it doesn't fit my mold.
Well,
and that's the way I deal with people.
You practice listening right now because, buddy, we've got less than 10 minutes, and I want to squeeze one more song in. Succession in Repression. Tell me a little bit about this. Tell us a little bit about this because I want to play it.
Succession in Repression is a song that I wrote for women to support them and say it's from a movie that I'm doing about domestic violence, and the part of domestic violence I'm referring to is controlling behavior. And I wrote that poem for women to support them and help them realize that you don't have to sacrifice the love you have to offer a relationship to be in a relationship. You need to keep some for yourself. And the guys, don't take. Don't just take. You need to, don't let someone burn themselves out loving you and not keep something for themselves by which they will drift into a succession of repression and start accepting things less than they deserve. And I'm really strongly adamant about that. You hear that, women? You don't have to lower your standard to be loved. The person
that wants love from you needs to
share the love. That's it. So don't fall into a succession of repression. So from my heart to yours, here it is.
Exactly why I wanted to end the show on this song. Here it is. Inside Norman Woods. Succession in Repression on Hyper Jazz from Trish Hennessy.
Love is falling into a black hole. To witness feeling sinking fast, watching, while at the same time question the succession of the repressed. Prisoner by choice, or just a victim of naivety? Love is not a scholarly thing, even though some try to make it academic. Will I ever get it? And if I do, will my lack of experience or piecemeal definitions reinforce a retrogressive sense of self-loathing? No need to check my notes, not me. I'm always falling short. And this will fuel the reasoning that makes it easier for insights and acute decisions to magically come to me, powered by ego, and make it easy to let go. Tell yourself, light the fuse of hurt, so that I will not be burdened with regret. Sing victory songs to those who say what they would never compromise. Well, I hope you know that from failure given before any test, from Neanderthal effort still secure at its best, a song will be sung breaking the secret code of an ancient language spoken by the unloved. and still strong is this look upon my face. After falling across the line in the sand of what most will not tolerate, one that has been drawn and moved countless times, I have ignored all the warnings to all who were dared not to cross. Only so that you might understand that if an opportunity to love falls from the sky, some voices of emotional liberalism will slowly grow faint, then evaporate. And you might find yourself alone, standing at the edge of the black hole, trying to decide if you should wipe with or toss in a towel, one that has been saturated with evidence of emotional truth. Believe me when I say, we've all been there. Or you will be pulled in by a succession of repression, never knowing if it was your chance you were throwing away.
I love the words in that, and I love the music. That's Norman Woods, who is coming to us as Inside today, Succession and Repression, Still Loving the Art of It. That's the CD where you can find it. And Norman, please, you know what? We haven't touched on this, but we have to wrap things up, as you know. Tell me where folks can find you.
They can find my CD, Just a Broke Brother Trying to Come Up. They'll be able to get Succession and Repression and Discovery. The first version of it is on that CD at CD Baby. Just a Broke Brother Trying to Come Up. Jazz Opera is also at CD Baby under Inside. And it's very important that people understand Inside is N-S-I-D-E.
Right.
That's in. And my film could be seen. You can go to the website, JourneyFromTheInsideMovie.com. And that's Inside with an N-S-I-D-E. Journey from the Inside. You can see clips from the movie. You can contact me. And, you know, that's it. I'm not going to talk anymore.
No, you did
now
fine. Look, you knew we were going to go past the hour anyway. But before too long, we'll hear the little British lady come on and say, 3 minutes. And before it gets to that point, thank you so much for allowing us this time. You have been a blessing to so many, and you're going to continue to be, and you never, ever forget that. I don't think that you will.
I will try not to, and God bless you for giving me a new life and a new perspective, reconnecting me with a new life and a new perspective on my contribution. And Debbie Poole and Matt and Zilda and all the new listeners, thank you for sharing the love with me, Baltimore.
Yeah, and well, you know what? There's Baltimore, and there's a lot more than Baltimore in this chat room. You know, usually it's been the scenario. Debbie Poole had a lot of folks in here in the chat room, and you did too. So I know you've been pushing this on your Facebook page. And I got to tell you, I got love in my heart for you, Norman. You're like my friend. You're like my brother. And one of these days in 2012, I think it's going to be that we'll meet in person, and I'm going to come find you at your bookstore, and I'm going to listen to you.
We will, and all the other areas besides Baltimore. Let's spread the love.
We will. We're spreading the love. That's so awesome, and I'm just tickled. So now that I have your work, it's going to be in the regular mix of Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy. Just so you know, this isn't a last-time deal. We'll be checking in again in the new year.
Appreciate it.
We appreciate you. You've turned on a lot of people to what you're doing, and there's more to come. So God bless you, and Merry Christmas, though I'm talking to you before, you know, during the holidays. And we'll see what transpires next. There's going to be good things. You know that, right?
That's right. And just remember, art unified in motion creates magic and healing, too.
Love that. All right, you.
All right.
Have a wonderful evening, and I'll talk to you soon.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Yes, yes, yes. That is the way we do it here, and I'm just so glad that things worked out that way. Oh, my gosh. You're going to hear the lady do it any minute. You have 2 minutes until the show ends. Thank you so much to everybody who joined us today. Matt and Griselda and Suzanne baking cookies, and Debbie Poole, who was listening behind Matt, and all our guests who wish to be anonymous. That's cool, too. We're going to have a very cool show on Thursday. I believe Chuck Redd is going to be with us, who was part of the Nate Najjar trio when they played Baltimore. So Chuck is one of these musicians that no stranger to the Baltimore, D.C. area, and he's known beyond. We have the show booked until, I believe, the end of January. So things are looking up. Thank you so much. Remember Cool Jazz Conversations on Monday at 7 o'clock Eastern Time. We'll see you again on Thursday between 2 and 4 Eastern Time right here. God bless.